The feds came to the rescue a week ago, right? So what am I missing?
This is a cascading crash, but a crash all the same as a result of lack of market participants and a total crisis of confidence in the U.S. financial system for the time being.
Rescue Rangers Chip and Dale would know what to do. I bet some brokers on Wall Street wish they were spending their afternoons watching cartoons instead of, well, you know, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 10th, and Rescue Rangers, not familiar with them.
We need the Rescue Rangers. Chip and Dale, they can do anything, the little gumshoes. Good morning, Adora.
Okay, I'm going to take your word for it. Good morning, John. Today, of course, we're going to have the latest on the market problems all over the world. Some are calling it a slow motion crash. We're going to ask you what you're calling it. A report from Iceland, a country that's been hit hard. And the psychology of fear, it's a cycle, and we're going to talk about that. And a story about musical competitions in the early days of the country. All that and more. But first, these headlines.
Markets in Asia and Europe have tanked. The Dow futures have plunged 250 points ahead of the opening bell on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average has dropped 21% in just 10 trading days. But don't panic. President Bush says the U.S. will survive.
We'll get through this deal. And the reason why I'm confident is because he got the most talented and productive workers in the world.
President will address the nation about this deal in a couple of hours.
Meanwhile, Prime Minister Gordon Brown says countries must come together to halt the financial freefall.
Working with other world leaders is essential. This is a global problem now. It's happening in every country, in every continent, and some of it requires global solutions.
Financial ministers from G7 countries will meet in Washington later today. They'll talk about whether to establish a joint emergency fund to give loans to nations hit by the growing financial crisis. And the crisis is hitting GM particularly hard. Its shares lost nearly a third of their value yesterday after a Standard & Poor's rating services announcement said the automaker's credit could fall further into junk status. And the White House may take North Korea off its list of terrorist countries after all. The announcement could come today and indicates the U.S. effort to revive disarmament talks. At a NATO meeting in Hungary yesterday, Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, laid out a new strategy in Afghanistan.
If we have the opportunity to go after drug lords and drug laboratories and try and interrupt this flow of cash to the Taliban, that seems to me like a legitimate security endeavor.
And it seems NATO defense ministers have agreed. A spokesman said today they've agreed their troops can target drug facilities.
Finland's ex-president Martti Ahtisaari is the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. The award recognizes his efforts to build a lasting peace places all over the world. In baseball, the Phillies took a one-game lead on the Dodgers, winning 3-2 last night. The ALCS kicks off tonight with Tampa Bay hosting the Boston Red Sox. Barack Obama's in Ohio. John McCain is in Wisconsin and Minnesota. And we want a new word to replace meltdown. Can you give it to us?
Yeah, financial meltdown. Is it a crisis? What is it, a panic, a depression?
Yeah, I mean, all morning long, you've been sharing your suggestions, and they've been fantastic. Keep them coming. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. They're already calling it Black Friday in Australia. Trading is suspended this morning in Russia, Indonesia, and for a time in Vienna. European markets are tanking. And in advance of the Wall Street open this morning, Dow Jones Industrial Futures are at their lows, about 259 down. Joining us to talk about all this is markets reporter for the Financial Times, Michael Hunter. Michael, we have to stop meeting like this, I think, really.
Good morning, John.
Yeah, good morning. So Europe did not have a very good day, or is not having a very good day at this point. Can you describe what's been going on there?
Yeah, we're seeing a continued draining of confidence out, not just of the financial sector, but the wider marketplace now, John. People are in uncharted territory, and there's a real cloud of fear hanging over not just the City of London, but also other European bosses this morning. I think one of the things people are looking to is the fact that today is the day we find out exactly how much money the people who've insured Lehman Brothers' debt are going to be liable to pay to other institutions who are directly exposed to that. And that's one of the reasons why we're seeing these terrible losses this morning.
Now, explain how that's going to be revealed. I guess there's paper related to credit default swaps. There are other sort of specific obligations that are going to be revealed today, and that's going to trigger redemptions in the market, which will then trigger selling. Do I have that sort of right?
That's exactly right. There's a long and ongoing auction process, basically, where these insurance policies are going to be exchanged between financial institutions who've written them and who are liable to pay them against other institutions who hold them and who understand they're not going to get all their money back. It's a long and complicated process. We've all been mulling over the way in which it might work in some very technical senses today, and we're still not entirely sure what's going to happen, but the standout numbers are fairly clear. There's a potential pool of money of some $400 billion which this involves. We've never had an investment bank of that size fail in the modern era before, and we reckon that people who are holding debt protection contracts are only going to get back around 12 or 13 cents in the dollar.
Or 13 cents. Now, that is the first clue for what the Fed will be buying when they begin coming into this troubled asset arena later on, perhaps as early as early next week. Right, Michael?
Very much so. That's exactly right, John. It's the first real insight into how that $700 billion TARP, Troubled Asset Relief Program, pool of money will be accounted for as the system carries on to try and work out exactly what's going on. Think of it in one way, John. There's a good way it was explained to me earlier today. If you have a mortgage on your house and you know that your house on the market cannot attract as much money as your mortgage is worth, you know you're in negative equity, you know your mortgage is worth more than your house, but you don't know exactly how much money you've lost until somebody buys your house.
Which brings me to something that I've heard people say repeatedly who work on the market, that there is this fundamental lack of confidence in the bailout plan or others because it's simply not enough money, that the potential losses so far exceed the bailout money that there's no way that's going to fix what's happening.
Well, Adora, I think we're about to find out whether those fears, and they're still just fears at this stage, are founded. We're getting those numbers in now. We're beginning to move to a position where we can kind of understand whether or not that pool of money will be sufficient, and if not, how much more might be required.
Well, quickly, Michael. I mean, it's always panic before the bottom, right? So yeah, it may be almost over.
Absolutely. The darkest hour, John, is always before the dawn. There was a very good quote going around Square Mile earlier today. Somebody was asked on one of the financial news channels whether or not, you know, we were seeing the end of modern capitalism as we understand it, the end of the capitalist world in that respect. And he said, well, it could well turn out to be that. We don't know for sure yet. But if it does turn out to be that, I'm going down fully invested.
Wow. Wow. So we've been asking our listeners all morning, if they have a suggestion to replace the word meltdown to describe this. You want to give a stab at it, Michael, before we go?
I think a good way, it's not quite as catchy as it might be, but you're looking at a bit of a re-evolution.
Re-evolution. I like it. No, that works. That works. We'll put it in the hopper. Thank you. Okay, Michael Hunter is Financial Times markets reporter joining us from London to describe what is a continuing sell-off. Adora?
And clearly, John, startling numbers in the marketplace yesterday continuing into today, and nothing the Federal Reserve, the Treasury Secretary, or central banks around the world do seems to be stabilizing the situation. David Weiss, the chief economist for Standard & Poor's, joins us now for his take. Our market analyst this morning, David, called this a classic panic phase. Good morning, and would you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. There's pure panic going on. We've dropped now, 21% in 7 days? That's about as close to panic as I've seen, certainly since 1987.
And it's also been described as a slow-motion crash. Is that accurate?
Not sure it's all that slow-motion anymore. It's been gathering speed for a while now.
Okay, so essentially, the market has reacted badly to the U.S.'s attempt at a bailout, to the U.S.'s talk about taking ownership in banks, and to interest rate cuts that were unprecedentedly coordinated worldwide. Why is there so much fear when action is being taken?
Well, these phases of a cycle, just panic sets in. People want out at any cost. They've seen their 401k plan go down. They say, look, I got to move this into cash before I lose everything. And I think that's the psychology right now. It looks to me like most of this is coming from individual investors trying to pull out of the market more than it is from the professionals.
So what is the Treasury or the Feds or any of the international bodies? What do they do? Is there anything left in their toolkit?
They're running out of tools. Obviously, you can cut rates again, but the last time that didn't do much. I think you will see some injection of liquidity into the banks to try to get credit markets moving again. But I've just never seen a time when not just are we seeing the crash in the stock market, but we're also seeing this total lockup in credit markets.
David, is it possible that one of the things driving this, you mentioned that it's individual investors now, and it's estimated, I think, individual investors represent about 50% of the U.S. stock markets. Is it possible that some of the volatility is accounted for by the fact that there are all these financial channels and there's people just sitting there watching these things go down and maybe listening on the radio and maybe going onto the internet, and that when people act, it's like pretty enormous, and it's easier to get people into a panic mode with all these financial channels on?
Yeah, I think you're underestimating the amount that's individual stock, for one thing, because the 50% is just direct ownership. What's really happening now is people selling off mutual funds.
Right.
And the mutual funds then having to sell stock in order to redeem those. And I think that's about 80% of the market. The rest of it's professionally managed stuff. I think, yeah, people are watching this. The most dangerous thing for your health is to watch too much television, and I think that's true of your financial health as well.
Well, let me ask you this, and this may be a simplistic question, but if the problem is the banks won't lend to each other, then why hasn't the actions taken to assure the markets or to ensure those transactions in a way that there's a backstop?
Well, because they're not sure where the backstop is. We've got the TARP in place, but it hasn't really been used yet. They don't know exactly what that's going to do. I think the inconsistency in, you know, first rescuing Bear Stearns, then not rescuing Lehman, and then rescuing AIG confused the market, so they're not sure who's safe and who's not safe. So I think people are just playing nervous, and they just don't want to lend to anybody because they're scared of losing money. People want their money under their bed where it's safe.
Well, talk about nervous. I heard brokers yesterday speaking publicly about and calling for the federal government to come in and buy stock futures to support this market. Have you ever heard of such a thing?
Certainly, we've never done that. We probably need legislation in order to do it.
Do you think it would help? Would it help?
I doubt it. I think people would see it as a sign of panic, too. I think at this point, almost nothing's going to help because people are just playing scared. Until the market turns around, they're not going to believe it.
Let's look forward to today. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson is meeting with European finance ministers. What do you think that meeting's going to be like? And is there anything that they can come out and say you think will turn the tide in any way?
I just don't know what it would be. They've tried a coordinated rate cut. What's needed is more coordination in how you do these rescues. I don't think you can do that over the weekend. Maybe we'll see some announcement of that over the weekend. We do have a three-day weekend coming up. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether that's good or bad, but it gives an extra day.
Well, we'll certainly see. David Weiss, thanks as always.
David, would you call this anything besides a crisis? I hate to interrupt you here before we go. We're looking for a new name here, Crisis Meltdown.
This is an old name, Panic.
Old name, Panic. David Weiss, Chief Economist for Standard & Poor's.
I meet your panic and raise you a... our audience has been weighing in with their
radio boo-boo on live radio.
Suggestions. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Give us a replacement for panic, for meltdown, for crisis, anything you want.
Oh, another boo-boo. Well, how about...
Hi, this is Tom from Vernon, Vermont, and I think we could start calling this meltdown era perhaps the post-gluttony era.
Post-gluttony era, that's a good candidate. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Think of us. We have to say meltdown every day. We want something different. Post-gluttony era is a good candidate.
Or how about psychological recession?
That's good.
We want to hear yours. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I think the new name for the fiscal phenomena we're experiencing should be the GA support bill. That's G for greed and A for avarice.
My term for it is evaporational exuberance.
How about psychological recession or perfect storm with earthquake chaser? We want to hear your thoughts on what to call what's happening in the economy. 8778-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org, and we're taking all entries.
And you guys are good. So we've been following bank failures over these last several weeks, but over in Europe, a nation is close to failing financially as a result of the credit crisis and the decline of stock shares and currencies. To get a sense of what this means for the people on the streets of Iceland, we turn to Alda Sigmundsdottir, who's a freelance writer, and she runs the blog in Reykjavik, IcelandWeatherReport.com. Alda, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, no problem. My pleasure.
So it seems to me there are at least two ways of looking at this. One, because Iceland's fortunes are so closely bound up with the European economy, if the European economy sneezes, Iceland, you know, is in a pneumonia kind of situation. And I'm wondering if that's partially what's going on here.
Yes, I think there's a definite domino effect, but I think it's global. It's not just European, and it's not necessarily that Iceland is just connected to Europe. It's the U.S. as well.
And I guess the question is, the mechanism that caused this collapse of the krona in Iceland involved banks around the world pulling their capital and their investments suddenly out of Iceland, and then things sort of proceeded from there?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. So,
credit lines froze up, basically. You could say that it's been a sort of a sequence of hapless events for the Icelandic authorities and the Icelandic Central Bank over the last week and a half or so. I think when the first bank went down, a lot of people here feel that it wasn't handled very well by our authorities, causing credit lines to freeze up for the remaining banks. There were three main commercial banks here, so that they just sort of collapsed one after the other.
And the krona is the currency there in Iceland, and I gather because of these events, the krona is no longer convertible. You can't go in and get francs or Italian lira or euros or dollars even. What does that mean for the average Icelandic person today trying to make ends meet or buy groceries even?
Well, at the moment, there's a lot of uncertainty here. We don't really know sort of from one day to the next what's going to happen. And I think we're all just sort of sitting here waiting and seeing what transpires. I believe our government, our central bank are doing everything they can to get the situation back on track. But we haven't really started to feel the effects of anything here yet. There is a limited amount of foreign currency that people can take out in the banks at the moment. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's sort of what people are feeling on a personal level, I think.
And you also talk about how there is a lot of anger and frustration. Would you describe that and how you're seeing it in cyberspace?
Yeah, I think there was an interview on Icelandic television last night with a doctor and professor at Reykjavik University, and he was sort of describing the effects on this whole situation on the nation. And he was saying we're sort of still halfway in the denial stage, where people just sort of can't really believe that this is happening, and moving into the anger stage, where there's a lot of anger just beginning to become evident. people are calling for the resignation of the central bank governors, our prime minister, our minister of finance. There are demonstrations that are being organized. There was one 2 days ago. There's another one called for today in front of the central bank. So people here feel that the situation hasn't been handled well. The policies that were set by our government previously could have averted the situation, and it just hasn't been handled properly, and that's why we're in this mess.
Alda, Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister, has said on more than one occasion this week that, you know, this all started in America and then went to the rest of the world, and he's looking for a way to keep America's troubles from infecting the British economy. Do people in Iceland and on the blogs, as you're seeing, blame the United States for this debacle?
No, I don't get that feeling at all. I don't get the feeling that the United States is being made into a scapegoat. At this very moment, there's a very sort of serious diplomatic conflict going on between the Iceland and the UK. It's another situation entirely, but no, I don't feel that the U.S. is particularly drawn into that.
Well, Alda, is there an Icelandic word for what's going on in the economy that you'd like to share with us?
An Icelandic word?
For debacle, for catastrophe, for financial meltdown? What would it be?
Katastrofa.
Katastrofa, indeed. Alda Sigmundsdottir is a freelance writer and runs the blog IcelandWeatherReport.com, where the weather today is katastrofa.
Thanks for that weather report.
Please, some headlines. Are you okay?
Good morning. It is 28 minutes past the hour. Share prices are continuing to fall sharply around the world. All the major European markets opened down and they recovered slightly later. Asia fell as well, with the Nikkei index closing around 10%. The upheaval caused at least six countries to suspend trading. As a solution to the credit problem, Japan is proposing that the world's industrialized countries set up a joint fund to provide emergency loans. Japan has experience injecting public money into banks from its debt crisis of the 1990s. We're just getting this news in the last 20 minutes or so. 10 people are dead in Pakistan after a suicide attack at a meeting of anti-insurgent tribalmen, and at least 50 at the moment are known to be injured. The meeting was taking place in a tribal region near the Afghan border. A Pakistan government spokesman says the gathering was planning to knock down a nearby militant base. Finland's ex-president Martti Ahtisaari is the winner of the 2008 Nobel Peace Prize, and that's for his efforts to build a lasting peace in places like East Timor and the Balkans in Europe. A spokesman says that NATO defense ministers have agreed that their troops can target drugs facilities funding the Afghan insurgency. Defense Secretary Robert Gates has been pushing for the change in tactic. And Bill Gates has lost $1.5 billion in about the last month or so. So he's now worth only $55.5 billion.
What a wuss.
Which means that Warren Buffett has overtaken Bill Gates as the richest American on the Forbes 400 list. And in the last 33 days, Warren Buffett has made $8 billion.
He's made $8 billion?
Warren I want Buffett to be has... his friend.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
$8 billion. That's certainly not catastrophe.
Capitalism must die. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I think a good name for the current situation is comeuppance. This is what happens when your philosophy is greed is good.
What we have here is a backed up toilet.
what we have here is an abundance of communication. 877-8-MY-TAKE to come up with a different name for the financial crisis than crisis or meltdown. You can also reach us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
To try to calm some of the anxiety of all these headlines, of all this bad economic news we seem to be getting day after day, President Bush plans to speak yet again to America. And no surprise, given that a new survey, the American Psychological Association survey, reports that 8 out of 10 Americans say the economy is a significant cause of stress. Dr. Karina Davidson joins us with some thoughts on stress and fear. She's a clinical psychologist at Columbia University. Good morning.
Good morning.
So take us through this process that many investors are feeling, whether they're big or small, from I'm not going to sell to I can't get to my broker fast enough to sell.
When people have unpredictable stress or uncontrollable stress, they start to feel panic, and particularly when it goes on for a while. I think one of the things we're seeing in Americans, both those who work in the financial markets and those outside, is those feelings of lack of control are starting to rise everywhere.
And so how does that stress play out? I mean, are we snapping at our spouses, at our kids? Are we obsessing by watching every tick on the meters of each market?
A lot of us are reporting that we're eating more, we're watching TV more, we're shopping more, we're doing things that aren't necessarily either healthy for us physically or that fix the problem. One of the things we'd like to encourage people to do is to start thinking about how they can cope with this level of stress that's more healthy for their bodies and their mind.
But how do you do that when you're fearing that your life savings or your retirement fund or your college fund for your kids is just going to disappear at any moment?
When you're dealing with crises like that, you have to take stock of your situation. Some people are better at doing that with friends or family. Others are better doing that with a piece of paper. And you write down what are the things that are within your control and what are the things that are not within your control. The things that are within your control, you need to make a plan for and start doing them. The things that are out of your control, you have to learn how to take yourself out of thinking about them all the time, because that's not helpful.
Doctor, is the situation in Iceland one of the things that's out of my control, probably?
Yes, probably. That's an excellent example.
Okay. So I should put that on the list of out of my control. All right,
right,
thank you. I just wanted to get that straight.
Right, or whether a bank fails or whether it survives. I mean, you talk about something interesting about how we feel out of control when there's nothing right in front of us that we can do, and that's why you're saying make these lists, because
yes,
that brings back some equilibrium?
It brings back a perspective. You can't change that it's going to rain tomorrow, can't change what's happening in Iceland, and snapping at people around you, not getting the work done in front of you, not going for that walk around the block is not going to fix what happens in Iceland. But you can go for the walk around the block if that's what helps bring your heart rate down and clear your mind a little.
And what role do you think, say, the president coming out and making statements, encouraging us all to be patient and realize that we are in uncharted water, does that help or not?
I think for many of us, we react to the way other people are reacting to a stressor. So if you're sitting on the stock floor and everyone around you is suddenly freaking out, you are going to freak out, even if you are seeing the same thing as if everyone around you went, well, that was really tough. I bet tomorrow's going to be better. I think I'm going to go home and have a good night's sleep and roll up my sleeves and do what needs to be done. The second situation, you'll feel less stressed.
You know, Dr. Davidson, President Bush is going to talk in about 2 hours, 3 hours or so. I imagine he's got a really long list of things he can't control at this point after what's been going on.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what's your advice to the president then as he speaks to the rest of us and tries to calm everyone's nerves?
I think a lot of what he can do is be calm, be assured, talk about the things people can do to help their own situation. For some of us, there may only be very short-term fixes that we can engage in, but human beings feel better if they're doing something to better their situation, even if it's only for the next hour or 2 hours. We feel better if we're at something that we know is a good thing than if we're sitting around feeling helpless.
Okay, Dr. Davidson, why don't you help on that with a new term or what you think of what's happening in the economies, both here and overseas?
What would you call it?
I would call it a psychological recession.
Psychological recession.
Okay. Right. Dr. Karina Davidson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Karina Davidson is a clinical psychologist at Columbia University, and she's also president of Health Psychology of the American Psychological Association. And she added to our conversation this morning about what to call the current financial situation. Now we're going to turn to Femi Okeh, who's got the latest headlines at this hour.
Thanks, Adora. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. European markets fell more than 10% at their opening, but recovered slightly later. The Dow looks likely to continue its decline. Futures are down more than 200 points. President Bush is scheduled to discuss the economic crisis again later this morning. GM has been hit especially hard in the massive sell-off yesterday. Their shares lost nearly a third of their value. Financial institutions and big oil companies also suffered big losses. NATO is joining the fight against Somali pirates. It sent military ships to protect boats off the coastline, and pirates are still holding a Ukrainian ship that was filled with military tanks. And the McCain campaign has issued its own report on the controversy known as Troopergate, and it clears Sarah Palin of any wrongdoing. Palin is the subject of an Alaska legislative investigation into whether she abused her power as governor by firing her public safety commission. A report on that event will be coming out later this morning. And the former President Jimmy Carter has been talking politics in Brussels this week. He blames the economic crisis on the Bush administration.
It's because of the atrocious economic policies of the Bush administration. 8 years ago, we had a surplus budget. We had very fine economic circumstances. We had low unemployment. We had very low inflation. But we've had profligate spending since Bush came into office.
And when President Carter was asked who he thought would be taking over the White House in January, this was his response.
I can't predict who's going to win unless my prayers are answered. But if Obama is elected, I think there'll be an instantaneous improvement in the image of America.
And on the campaign trail this morning, Sarah Palin is holding a finance event in Ohio. Barack Obama is also in Ohio. And John McCain is in La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, I'm Adora Udoji. It's The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And Peter Jeffrey, you write the Reply to All column in The Wall Street Journal, correct?
That's right, John.
And it's great to have you here. I suspect when things start going crazy on Wall Street, like they've been doing this week, the editors come to you and say, okay, Jeffrey, we need some humor now. Let's come up with it, right?
It's terrifying. I try to hide under the desk, but it never works.
But you can always find, I guess I wouldn't call it a silver lining, but a scenario worse than what's going on Wall Street for real. Would you care to share some?
It wasn't easy, and that's what prompted this column. I couldn't imagine what could happen tomorrow. And I just went into a trance and thought, well, the vulcanized debentures market will melt down. And doesn't exist, but I thought that's the only thing that could happen.
And what are vulcanized debentures?
Well, in my imagination, I just could easily see picking up the paper the next morning, see bottom falls out of the vulcanized debentures market, and they are neither debt nor equity, but a kind of rubbery half promise, like the one you make to your cousin Stu that you won't wait till the next funeral to see him again.
So IOU is made up by some German bankers or something on the backs of napkins.
Yeah, devised on a napkin, and then they melt down because Citigroup has been propping them up with winks and nods at the auctions, and Then they're acquired by Facebook, and ultimately it all just melts down.
Now, this is pretty scary here. The implosion of the giant penny jars caused by monetary pressure from our negative savings rate. That sounds pretty scary.
Our negative savings rate and nature's abhorrence of a vacuum, they come together to cause penny jars across America to crack and all the pennies spill out, which upsets the balance of payments and mom, because it's a mess all over the carpet.
Could the candle market actually seize up?
It could, and this is one of the great fears of the Chandlers, which would probably be the next thing I could imagine happening in this scenario. I tried to approach the column in a way that was both respectful of the pain that people were going through, but tried to find a way to see what was funny about it. And the only thing that was funny to me was just how ghastly and absurd it all is.
Well, it's amazing to me that the feta arbitrage is related to the cheese bubble, and if that should burst, you know, what's going to happen?
Yeah, all those bankers went into feta arbitrage, and they used several factors to try to guess at the price of the cheese, the U-RAM ratios, disappointed Greek diner patrons who were paying too much. And
olive derivatives. I mean, sure, there you go.
The faulty O-rings. We should all be petrified of that.
They caused the alternative minimum tax to suck in together both rich people and poor people who couldn't agree on anything.
What
to watch on TV.
Now, that hasn't happened, right?
Not yet.
Okay.
But just give it 24 hours.
All right, Peter, you're a creative guy. You're a funny guy. You also work for the Wall Street Journal. If you were to come up with a new name for what's going on now on Wall Street and the global markets, it might actually stick. Any ideas? Any stabs you want to take?
I think Lassie, because Lassie was a very soothing, nice presence, and I think we need something to take a bit of the scare and a bit of the bite out of what's going on.
All right, but that's not a descriptive term. You're saying what we need now is Lassie.
Mm, yeah.
Okay, we should get the Lassie theme together for that. If you were to actually use a descriptive term to replace meltdown or crisis or something like that, any ideas?
I think which would be H-U-U-U-U-U-U-I-I. I think would have to be the descriptive term.
That's pretty good. We've got that recorded, right? Okay, Peter Jeffrey writes the Reply to All column in the Wall Street Journal. He's here with us in the studio, and I want you to keep thinking. Keep that thinking cap on, Peter, all right? Other scenarios coming up, real and imagined. And stay tuned for a musical debate.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 10th, and Femi Oke has just joined us, and she's got the latest headlines of the hour. Femi?
Thank you very much. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Stocks plunged in Asia today, with the Nikkei down a near record 10% at the close. Leaders from industrialized countries in the G7 are scheduled to meet in Washington today to discuss global approaches to the financial crisis. Sweden used a plan very similar to the government bailout during its banking crisis in the 1990s. When the financial system improved, the government began recovering more than half the initial costs to Swedish taxpayers. And one expert, Professor Hans Tesson Sonstrom of the Stockholm School of Economics, says that countries are making the correct moves to ensure economic activity continues. NATO is joining other international forces in the fight against Somali pirates. The organization sent military ships to protect boats off the coastline of the country. Pirates took a Ukrainian ship laden with 33 tanks captive there 2 weeks ago, and they're continuing to hold on to that cargo. At least 100 Somali refugees are thought to be dead after being forced overboard by smugglers on their way to Yemen. A report said that 32,000 African refugees have fled to the Arab country this year. That news comes in from the Associated Press. And finally, our partners at the BBC in Rome have tracked down the person they say who could be Barack Obama's oldest supporter. Sister Cecile Gaudet is a 106-year-old American nun from New Hampshire. She now lives in Rome and is planning to vote from abroad. And I will bring you that sound a little bit later on, but she's... She's a pretty impressive Obama supporter. That's a look at your news for now. Back to you guys.
Thank you, Femi.
Thanks, Fem.
It's hard to remember with all the headlines, but a couple of days ago, there was a debate between Barack Obama and John McCain. And often around here at WNYC, when something big happens in the headlines, we get a call from our friend and evening music host here on WNYC, Terrence McKnight, who said, political debate, hey guys, I can give you a musical debate. Invite me on the show on Friday. And of course, we always do. And it turns out long ago, there were things called cutting contests, kind of precursors to Battle of the Bands. Audiences would gather to watch musicians do something like a smackdown. It's a really big deal in the 1920s. And Terrence, good morning. You're going to tell us about a cutting contest that took place quite a long time ago. Explain.
Well, I brought a story that you and Adora would enjoy. It's part music, part history, part politics. So before these cutting contests, when you would have, you know, Willie the Lion Smith and James P. Johnson, all these guys getting together trying to outdo one another, back in 1880, there were two guys, both sightless, who came together to outdo one another. So I want to tell you, about these two guys. First of all, there was a guy named Thomas Wiggins Bethune. He was born in 1849. He was born on a plantation in Georgia. And so he was born into slavery. And by the time he was three, his family, his master realized that he had a talent. So he started playing piano. And by the time he was five, he composed this music. It's called The Rainstorm.
Oh, wow.
And you'll be able to hear this storm coming through Georgia as the music continues. So Tom, this kid, by the time he's eight, he's going around the state, going around the country, touring, and he's playing concerts. Beethoven, Mozart, Bach.
He's kind of a prodigy like Mozart.
Prodigy, yeah. Mm. He was considered autistic savant.
Mm-hmm.
Tom could, he could talk in different languages, not really understanding what he was saying, but he would just imitate the sounds. Now you get him imitating a sound of a storm here.
Nice.
It's a rainy night in Georgia.
Yeah, there you go.
So now, by 1860, right before the Civil War started, Tom was amassing $20,000, $30,000 a year.
Oh, my goodness. And this is in the
1880s. This is in 1860. So by the time the Civil War is going and at the height of his career, he's bringing in $100,000 a year. Now, the irony is that his master, Bethune, was using this money to support the Confederate efforts. Yes.
Oh, so the master got all the money.
Right, right, that's right. So now at the same time, in 1864, you have this guy, William Boone, John William Boone, who was born in a Union Army camp. His father was white, his mother was black, and she, his mother, would clean homes for people. And so this kid would hear these piano lessons being played by these children. And this is Tom right here. You get a sense of his southern roots.
So this is Blind Tom.
We're back to Blind Tom now. Now listen to this. Listen at this. Those sounds that he's making underneath the piano. He would whistle. He would make grunting sounds, and he would do all this stuff while he would play. Sometimes he would play one tune in one hand, another tune in another hand, and whistle at the same time. Now, this guy, Blind Boone, fashioned his career after Blind Tom.
But he's on the Union side.
He's on the Union side. And so Tom comes to Missouri in 1880 for this piano showdown between Tom, the old guard, and Blind Boone, the younger. And the audience is in this hall, segregated audience, whites on one side, blacks on one side. You've got the stage full, and Tom is back. Boone is backstage listening to Tom woo the audience. People are going crazy. And after Tom plays, Boone comes on stage and he plays exactly what Tom does. And Tom and Boone plays a piece for Tom. Tom plays exactly what Boone does.
Whoa.
And so the audience starts going crazy. And so you get a sense that politics is local because Boone didn't outdo Tom, but he certainly at least broke even.
And matched him.
That's right. And so Tom passed the torch to Boone, and he never showed up in that area again. He He never showed up in Missouri again for the rest of his life. This is 1880. Tom lived to 1908, so he gave the territory to Boone.
To the young man.
So it was a real smackdown.
I guess so. It goes to show that reality, American reality, is sometimes stranger than reality TV.
But it was the older guy making room for the younger guy.
That's right.
And Boone played until the end of his career and died in 1927. And was he still bringing in audiences till the end?
He was. He brought in audiences to the end. In fact, he played more than 26,000 concerts, Boone did.
26,000?
26,000 concerts. And both of these guys died pretty much in poverty. Blind Thomas buried here in Brooklyn. Died in Hoboken, New Jersey, and he's buried here in Brooklyn. And Blind Boone is buried in Missouri. And there are still, events around Blind Boone. But both of these guys, when they died, both of their musics kind of died with them. Mm-hmm. So there's been a resurgence. And I should mention that the pianist that we're listening to, his name is John Davis. He's a New Yorker. And he recorded this. It's the first commercial recording of Blind Tom's music was done in 1999. And John has since released a recording of Blind Boone's music earlier this year.
Well, Terrence, thanks so much. And like political debates, the outcome is uncertain. Yet it might be fascinating to get Barack Obama and John McCain in front of a keyboard instead of listening to their stump speeches on stage there. Peter Jeffrey is with us still from the Wall Street Journal. Do you sense an outcome from this debate, a definitive outcome from this musical debate?
From the musical debate? I don't know. I don't know. It's a fascinating story. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. It's, I mean, and now, with CDs and the music industry the way it is now, the idea of having, J-Lo and Shakira on stage doing a sing-off. Yeah, maybe that could happen.
That's something to visualize about. Let's stop and think about that for a minute.
Terrence, do you have a name for the financial catastrophe before we go? Besides meltdown?
What financial catastrophe?
What financial catastrophe?
The one from yesterday or the one from...
What? That's perfect. Thank you. Terrence McKnight, host of WNYC's Evening Music, and Peter Jeffrey, the reply to all columnist in the Wall Street Journal. We're always on.
We certainly are here at The Takeaway, all hour we've been asking you what your word for economic crisis is.
We'll get through this deal.
I think a good way, it's not quite as catchy as it might be, but you're looking at a bit of a re-evolution.
Economic extended bad hair day.
The redistribution of wealth.
This is an old name, panic.
The psychological recession.
The Great Wall Street Robbery.
The post-gluttony era.
Catastrofa. We say.
What financial catastrophe?
What financial catastrophe?
Or just, you could sum it up like this, maybe.
That's Peter Jeffrey. Tell us your word for economic crisis at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Keep calling. We'll never have a winner.
And here's a thought on a takeaway for the day.
Panic sets in. People want out at any cost.
That's David Weiss, chief economist for Standard & Poor's.
And on our election site, vote2008.thetakeaway.org, you'll find tools for tracking the candidates, posts from bloggers watching the campaigns, and the economic crisis from abroad. There's a link to all our election coverage from our homepage, thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I've got a word.
You got one?
How about big mess?
Big mess?
The big
Messorama.
Mess. The big mess.
You know what I thought of it, calling it?
What?
An endless parade of white guys in suits screaming. That's the financial channels this week.
That's actually quite accurate, John. Brilliant.
I'm John Hockenberry.
Of Adore You Doji.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Financial blues traveling. They're trying to learn lessons from this market slide, but it just keeps sliding. Big financial wizards, fresh out of euphemisms, were using the C word yesterday, calling a crash on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 10th. And in fact, John, some analysts this morning are calling it the classic panic phase of the international markets.
Panic. Good morning, Adora.
Yeah, good morning to you, too. Today, we're going to have the latest, of course, on the markets and a report on the enormous troubles GM is facing. Also, we'll talk to a Republican official battling to save seats on Capitol Hill. And the voice of Republicans, you've definitely heard them before. Stories you may have missed. Also, with all the bad economic news, there are other things happening in the world. We're going to get to those. All that, but first, some headlines.
And we begin with the market. Yesterday's dismal mood on Wall Street has spread across global markets. European and Asian stocks have plummeted. In Vienna, the stock exchange has been suspended until midday after stocks tumbled 10% at the opening bell. President Bush said yesterday he's still confident that the U.S. will survive.
We'll get through this deal. And the reason why I'm confident is because he got the most talented and productive workers in the world.
And the president will address the nation in a few hours.
Meanwhile, the British financial system isn't doing much better. Prime Minister Gordon Brown says, though, he has a plan.
We're going to have to get agreement on basic principles that underline a banking system. So what happens in America can no longer infect, because something has gone wrong there, what's happening in Britain.
Financial ministers from the G7 countries will meet in Washington later today. They'll discuss whether to establish a joint fund to give emergency loans to nations hit by the growing financial crisis. GM is really struggling. Its shares lost nearly a third of their value yesterday, hitting the lowest level in nearly 60 years. The fall was prompted by a Standard & Poor's rating services announcement that the automaker's credit could fall further into junk status, making it even tougher to borrow money. The Bush administration is nearing a decision to remove North Korea from a terrorism blacklist. The Associated Press has learned it could do so as early as Friday in a bid to salvage faltering nuclear disarmament talks.
Finland's ex-president Martti Ahtisaari is the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. The Academy says the award recognizes his efforts to build a lasting peace in places as diverse as East Timor and the Balkans. In baseball last night, the Phillies took a one-game lead on the Dodgers, winning 3-1 last night in a thriller. The ALCS kicks off tonight with Tampa Bay hosting the Boston Red Sox. Barack Obama's in Ohio today. John McCain is in Wisconsin and Minnesota. As we mentioned, Wall Street is poised to open lower this morning. The S&P begins today at 9:09. Oil prices have plummeted to a one-year low, below $83 a barrel today. So the question is, if you don't want to call it a meltdown, if you don't want to call it a crash, come up with a new name.
If I could suggest a takeaway question, I think listeners should call in to voice their preference for a new banner term to describe the market carnage.
Hear, hear. Our friend Troy in North Dakota challenges you to come up with a new name for market carnage at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Syllables accepted, like...
Absolutely. Financial meltdown, though, is not accepted. We need something new.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Another quick look at the markets. A dive of 10% in Europe and Japan. Trading is suspended in Vienna for a few hours. Oil prices have lost about 5% this morning. The president will be addressing the nation at 10 o'clock to talk about the economic crisis. If you watched trading on Wall Street yesterday, you may have noticed that the last hour was particularly draconian. And it followed, the sell-off followed a report from Standard & Poor's that General Motors was being downgraded. It's an indication that not only does the Standard & Poor's rating service consider that General Motors is a bad risk to pay back loans, but that General Motors might not even be around sometime in 2009. Joining us is Bill Vlasic, Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
The S&P downgrade was, I think, particularly alarming in the sense that GM has some very stark financial deadlines that they have to meet in the next few months, or they're literally not going to make it. Could you explain?
Well, General Motors has been under tremendous pressure, as has Ford Motor Company. to have enough cash to fund their operations. They are burning through at GM more than $1 billion a month and beyond their revenues. And, of course, revenues are shrinking because the car market is in a downward spiral. There's been a couple of reports recently that we may see less than 14 million in auto sales this year. And these are really deep losses in the market, in the automotive market. So GM thought that they may have a liquidity plan based on cutting costs and selling assets to boost their cash to maintain their financial health to get through this. But the lower the car sales go, the less that plan looks viable.
And it appears to me, by doing the arithmetic, that General Motors in 1929 was capitalized to something to the tune of $4 billion. Today, it's something on the order of $2.9 billion capitalized, meaning the value of all the outstanding stock. I mean, that's an outrageous decline, and the stock hasn't traded this low since 1950?
Well, these are times that are unprecedented. Because in 1929, the world was different. GM controlled the car market then. GM no longer controls the car market. GM and Ford could be bought for less than $8 billion for the two of them. Question is, who would want to buy these companies? They're, again, burning through billions in cash. They're losing billions on top of that, and they have just enormous obligations in pension and health care to retirees and active workers. Both companies have cut and cut and cut and are downsizing dramatically, and in fact have been doing well internationally, which was their saving.
Bill? Oh, we've lost Bill Vlasic, the Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times. And General Motors, as we were saying, is having really significant problems in this market. And I guess what's so disheartening for General Motors, if we were the management of General Motors, and I would not want to be at this point,
no.
Oil prices are declining. I mean, in theory, General Motors ought to be able to take advantage of declining oil prices by selling vehicles. But with the credit crisis and the credit markets frozen up, they can't sell cars because people can't get loans.
Oil prices are down, and also part of the Bush bailout plan is the auto companies picking
billion.
Up $25 billion.
Right.
Dollars. Right. So there's a pot of money to help them move forward, but they're running into a brick wall, which is this financial crisis.
Bill's back with us, Detroit bureau chief of the New York Times. Bill, you know, you would think in theory with oil prices falling off 40% from their highs, more than 40% from their highs, that an auto company could take advantage of this, but the credit crisis means it is really a brick wall for General Motors.
This credit crunch has been tough for all automakers, not just GM and Ford. September was the first month in 15 years that less than a million cars were sold in this country in a month. Even Toyota was down over 30% during the month. So this freeze in the credit market has been a disaster. And on top of that, consumers, as we all know, are wary, frightened, and just not shopping right now. So General Motors and Ford are trying to stimulate demand. They all these companies have some competitive products, but you can't lead a horse to water and force it to drink.
And Bill, John and I, when we lost you briefly here, we're just talking about the $25 billion that are slated to head to the auto companies in light of Bush's bailout plan. So there was sort of some good news on the horizon until this last 10 days or so.
Yeah, and that was separate from the financial bailout on Wall Street. I mean, this was a loan program that had been put in the fuel economy bill last year and was designed specifically to assist these companies in converting plants to build more fuel-efficient vehicles. They desperately need those dollars. The question is, how quickly can they get those? The loans were funded just a couple weeks ago now, and the Department of Energy has to write regs and process these loans. But they've got to get them soon. This can't wait 18 months or a year.
Right.
These companies are in need now.
They need the cash now. And, you know, one of the things that surprised me yesterday was seeing that General Motors isn't the only one affected. You've already mentioned Ford, but even Toyota is having problems in this environment. How broadly is the auto industry affected by this? And maybe there's just too many auto companies around.
Well, yesterday, J.D. Power put out their forecast, which was very bleak, 13.6 million vehicle sales this year, 13.2 million in the U.S. next year. I mean, we're used to 8 or 9 years now of 16 million sales a year. These are historic drops of 20% annually. There's been a new competition in the market in the last several years. Obviously, the foreign automakers have built plants in this country and added capacity. There's a lot of great models out there, and in this case, a lot of good products chasing too few customers. So there will be a shakeout, and if it claims General Motors, it would be one of the turning points in automotive history.
And, Bill, what does the latest news mean for Detroit, for the state of Michigan, for the Midwest, in manufacturing and the car and the auto industry?
Well, Michigan has taken it on the chin for the last couple of years. We have one of the highest unemployment rates in the country, and we've lost hundreds of thousands of manufacturing jobs just in the last 3 years alone. Ironically, I was at the ceremonial opening of the new Toyota Technical Center outside of Ann Arbor, Michigan yesterday, a beautiful new $180 million facility where the governor of the state of Michigan was there to celebrate Toyota investing in the state. Anything that's done here, whether it's by Toyota, GM, or whomever, is welcome at this point because the Rust Belt is really on the skids.
30 years ago, they were sledgehammering Japanese cars in Detroit parking lots. Now the governor is meeting with executives from Toyota. If there was ever a connection more strongly from Wall Street to Main Street, it's certainly the extent to which General Motors is connected to the broad economy in the United States. Beyond manufacturing of cars and the parts suppliers, where else is General Motors' impact felt in the United States, in the U.S. economy?
Well, General Motors has plants all over the United States, but not just that, they're suppliers. It's a pyramid. Their suppliers are broad-based. Their dealers are in the thousands. Every dealer employs people across the country. And then GM has well over a million retirees who they pay almost their full health care for, not to mention pensions. These are people that, and the dealers and the suppliers, if they lose their jobs, there'll be a ripple effect. If GM were to go bankrupt,
that would stop the pensions. Yep,
would disappear. It's going to raise the question ultimately is whether or not the federal government thinks that General Motors and Ford Motor Company and possibly Chrysler are as important to financially protect as they have
AIG and the
Wall Street.
Sure. Bill, we've been asking everyone today, what's another name for this financial meltdown? You got a name for us quickly before we go?
Oh, well, meltdown to me always conjures up nuclear reactors.
Quickly.
We use this. It's the perfect storm with the earthquake.
Perfect storm with the earthquake chaser. You know? That's great. Bill Vlasic, Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
On this Friday, October 10th, as the markets are tumbling all over the world, John and I are looking for new words to describe this economic crisis, meltdown, recession, depression, panic.
My grandmother was always looking for signs that the end of the world was near, and I think the little bit of grandma that's in me would call this the apocalypse.
Thanks, Grandma. Rich on our website says, why do we talk about the problem in terms that scare us to death? We could call it the oopsie of 2008. Rich says, thanks for being out there for us. You can be out there for us. Call us with your new name to describe the financial whatever at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
And all the market troubles are certainly having some ripple effects into the presidential election. And as in every election, there are moments, or there is that moment, when accusations start flying about negative ads.
Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton.
He dishonored his country and, more importantly, the people he served with.
Swift Boat Veterans for Truth is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
They call themselves Mavericks. Whoa. Truth is, they're anything but.
Why would Barack Obama be friends with someone who bombed the Capitol and is proud of it? Do you know enough to elect Barack Obama?
That's just a sampling of some of the negative ads over the years and some from this election cycle. The Wisconsin Advertising Project reports that as of the last week of September, Republican John McCain's ads have become nearly 100% negative. John Greer is on the line from Nashville. He's a professor of political science at Vanderbilt University and the author of In Defense of Negativity. So, Professor Greer, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
So, let's start with what is a negative campaign, and does everyone agree what they are?
Well, that's a tough one because people don't agree. I mean, there's a lot of miscommunication. If you ask kind of academics and, you know, journalists and pundits, you know, any kind of an attack is viewed as negative. So if you attack someone for supporting sex education for kindergartners, as McCain did earlier this year against Obama, that would be negative. But while all that, and then any kind of personal attack, like raising doubts about Bill Ayers or questioning whether John McCain's really a maverick, would also be negative. But for the public, they define negative as not any attack on someone's views on issues, but personal attacks. And so there's kind of this disconnect, this miscommunication that goes back and forward, where the public thinks there's been this huge rise in attacks, which there have, but not on personal attacks. That hasn't been increasing over the last 40 years. What has been increasing is attacks on issues. And so you have this miscommunication, and people have their own definition of negativity, and it just creates misleading, you know, not misleading information, but doesn't allow people to see what really is going on.
So when we hear the Ayers ads, that being about Bill Ayers in Chicago and the link between him and Barack Obama, those kinds of ads coming from McCain's campaign about Obama's judgment, what does that say to you about where his campaign is?
Well, it says that they're in trouble. I mean, and we've known that for a while. I mean, the conditions are very harsh. And, you know, it's a tough year for Republicans to run. You have an economy that's, you know, 2 weeks ago I said it was sagging, and now it may be even doing more than that. You have an unpopular war and a very unpopular president. That means any Republican this year, whether running for president, Congress, or a local race, is going to be in trouble. And so McCain is looking for something to run on, and he doesn't have a lot to run on, but he does have this one thing to play is, do people know who Obama is, and can they trust him, and is he ready to lead? And that's what they're going to hammer with for the last 4 weeks, or now less than 4 weeks.
And when you take a look at that strategy, what do you say to yourself? I mean, does that really work? And even though voters routinely say they don't like quote-unquote negative ads, can they escape being influenced by them?
Well, I think that, I mean, people say they don't like negative ads, and we know that negative ads work just as positive ads work. I mean, I don't think there's much difference between the effectiveness of different types of ads. But, you know, the bottom line is that when you go to this kind of strategy, you do it because you're behind. And it's not likely to change the campaign. Right now, if the election were held today, Barack Obama would probably have a pretty comfortable win. Now, if over the next 3 weeks, let's say Barack Obama makes some huge mistake or some new piece of information comes out, that, you know, that could shake up the race. But, you know, there's a huge headwind that McCain's running into, and Obama has a huge tailwind. And it's just the way these elections work, just like it happened in 1992 for Bill Clinton's benefit and 1980 for Ronald Reagan's.
Professor Geer, isn't there an issue of timing with negative ads, though? I mean, in the montage, we heard the Dukakis ad, the Willie Horton, that was so devastating. It's not simply the ad, it's also the timing. You have to get an ad or a negative idea into people's mind, but it's got to be close enough to the actual voting that they don't get a chance to talk it through reasonably with a lot of friends or people with alternative views, right?
Well, that's actually an interesting question. We don't know, as the field of political science doesn't know much about the timing in the sense of how that might affect an ad's impact. We do know that over the course of a campaign, they tend to get more and more negative as you get closer to the election. And we also know that if people don't know as much about a candidate, it's harder to move them. So, for example, John Kerry aired a lot of negative ads in 2004, but it didn't affect people's position about Bush. They already had made a decision about Bush. Either they liked Bush or they didn't like Bush, and these ads don't have that kind of an effect. And I think that's probably true to some degree for John McCain. That is, that people have an opinion about him, and it's harder for the ads to move. But for Obama, it does matter. And in the counter hypothesis to yours is that if you can get those negative ads out early before people have formed an impression, you might be able to get, you know, push the candidate's perception or people's perception of the candidate down a particular road. So it's not clear that the timing of the ad is leads you to one way or the other. The more important thing is to play off the context, to hit a responsive chord. And what I mean by that is that I think it's fair game to raise questions about, is Obama ready to lead? Is Obama, do we know enough about Obama to trust him with the presidency? But imagine instead that we were attacking Obama for not being smart enough to be president. Well, that would never work because the guy is smart. Or imagine attacking John McCain for being unpatriotic. I mean, that'd be a disaster. Why? Because he may be many things, but McCain's a true patriot.
John Geer, he gave us some things to think about when we watch these ads that no doubt will becoming fast and furiously in the next couple of weeks. John Geer, professor of political science at Vanderbilt University and editor of the Journal of Politics and the author of The In Defense of Negativity. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And now,
quick financial headlines from Femi Okay.
The Dow Jones Industrial Futures are down 250 points ahead of the open. Markets in Asia plummeted this morning, and the Nikkei closed down 10%. And Japan is proposing that the world's industrialized countries set up a joint fund to provide emergency loans. That's a quick look at your news. More later.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 10th, and we have the latest headlines from Femi Okay right now. Femi?
Hello there. Just coming up to 28 minutes to the top of the hour. Finland's ex-president Martti Ahtisaari is the winner of the 2008 Nobel Peace Prize, and that's for his efforts to build a lasting peace in places as diverse as East Timor and the Balkans in Europe. Ahtisaari says that he was very pleased and grateful to get the award. And we'll have more news on Finland's former president later in the program. After a week of battling with Citigroup, Wells Fargo is the winner. It will buy Wachovia for almost $12 billion, and it will give Wells Fargo the most bank branches in the United States. And AP is reporting that Citigroup is looking for $60 billion in compensation for breach of contract. A spokesman says that NATO defense ministers have agreed their troops can target drugs facilities funding the Afghan insurgency. Defense Secretary Robert Gates has been pushing for the change in tactic. At least nine people, are dead after a suspected U.S. missile strike near the Afghan border in Pakistan, and that's according to Pakistani officials. The attack seems to be part of a surge targeting militants in Pakistan. And the Dalai Lama successfully underwent gallstone surgery. The spiritual leader was hospitalized yesterday evening in Mumbai after experiencing abdominal pain, and doctors say he was suffering from exhaustion. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
Today we're, of course, covering what's happening both in the markets here in the U.S. but abroad. And we're also asking you, what's a new word for this? Crisis? Financial meltdown? What do you think?
Hi, this is Elizabeth Ingram, and I'd like to say the new term is economics.
There's a thought. We want to hear what your thought is, 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. John?
So if you're looking at the campaign and you're thinking Republicans, Republicans actually are hard to pin down on the issues. There are some who are pro-choice. There are some who are pro-life. Also, some are pro-war. Some are anti-war. Some are pro-bailout. Some are anti-bailout. But the voice of Republicans? Oh, hey, that's easy.
He sees every day as a new blessing and a new beginning. Congressman Mike Pence. Here in the Hoosier heartland, we live our lives with a faithful heart and an optimistic spirit. Congressman Mike Pence believes in the promise and purpose of this shining city on a hill, because America is a place where any dream can come true if you just work for it.
I'm Mike Pence, and I approve this message.
Well, whatever you think about Congressman Mike Pence, the voice there that's selling you Mike Pence is Bob Jump. He's a voiceover artist and appears on many, many Republican commercials. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. And wow, you know, with the world markets plunging like that, I guess I'm the comic relief this morning.
Yes. Well, would you like to try a shot at coming up with a new name for the market?
No, I heard that. And I think the one lady was right on the money, you know.
Eco. It's better when you say it, though. They call it economics.
Yes, economics.
Did you audition to be the voice of these Republican ads? And if so, did they have any sort of guidance when you went into the studio?
No, not really. I mean, I got it through commercials. That's basically, you know, everybody I think that does this work. They started in commercials. I voiced spots for Smuckers, Toyota, Disney, NASCAR. You know, one day somebody called up and said, "Hey, do you do politicals?" And I said, "You know, it depends. Is there a paycheck involved?" So
perhaps they'd listen to this part of your body of work.
Armor all. Put it on. And it's always there. It's strong protection.
Fights rust.
So, John, I have to ask you,
inflation.
Are you sitting there with a cart machine?
I don't have a cart machine, but I have a very skilled control room. Dylan is running the board for us today.
Okay.
So I love the – what do you think is the quality in your voice that says security, importance?
You know, that is interesting.
Gravitas.
Because the people have told me that I've got that certain sound that Republicans like, you know, and yeah, I shake my head. I just don't know. Maybe it's the way I speak. I had one Republican client tell me that when I say words like bankruptcy and divorce, it doesn't seem so bad.
That's kind of scary. Have you ever gotten though some copy and you thought to yourself, is any of this stuff true?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and you look at it and you shake your head and you say, well, you know what? I got to read it. And every now and then, it comes across the desk. But here's the distinction. I'm a paid voiceover performer. I'm given a script that I didn't write, and I'm told what to read and how to read it. In other words, they're not asking me to endorse the candidate. Just sell it. And that's my job.
Who are the masters in your profession, particularly in the political arena, besides you, Bob?
There are no other masters, John.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, that's the case. I want you to listen to, you know, the late LaFontaine, who just died, who did tons of voiceovers. And this is actually is a political message, even though it is a movie. Take a listen to this, Bob.
There's a crisis in the White House.
If it gets out, you leaked it.
And to save the election,
just got to distract them.
They'd have to fake a war.
You're kidding.
It looks real.
When it's cooking, it's cooking.
It sounds real.
Give me some screaming.
It just never happened.
You're the man.
That, of course, is the trailer from the movie Wag the Dog, and Don LaFontaine, right, who just died, did the voice there. It sounds like this is all sort of part of a piece. It's breathy, it's deep, and
yeah,
it's
you really learn how to work the mic, and because sometimes you can overproject, and you've got to pull it back, and sometimes less is more in this business.
Wouldn't it be better, though, ultimately, for a democracy if candidates themselves spoke? I mean, because you always get to the end of the ad, and after you're done saying, "Freedom in America, I'm Bob Spence, and I approve this right. message." It sort of really is ragged. I don't like that.
Yeah, down south, "I'm Bob Chuckleberry, and I endorse this message here."
I mean, it really sort of demolishes the whole thing.
Well, it brings it down back to earth, don't you think, Bob? It makes it more real.
I'm sorry, say it again, Adora.
No, it brings us down to earth when we actually hear the candidate compared to your voice. As you said, you're a professional.
Oh, yeah. I'm snapped back to reality.
Yeah. So you're going to run for something, Bob, ever?
You think not going to run.
Ever thought about it? Ever thought about it?
I'll run away as far as I can from that.
You ever think about doing a Democratic ad? Would you do that?
Well, it's not that I would think about it. Years ago, Adora, I had played both sides, but the problem you'd run into is when you go back and you look through 5 years of political scripts and you find that the Republicans were really picking you. 70% of my work was for Republicans.
Wow.
You don't want to
mess with the brand. Don't mess with the brand. So since LaFontaine is gone, you going to take over the movies?
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, do a couple. Do a "In a World Where." Can you do that line?
Where John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji are hosts of The Takeaway. You are there.
This is the world that we, in fact, live in. That was
fabulous,
Bob.
Not a bad
ad-lib,
was it?
Love that,
Bob. Just came right off the top of my head.
All right, before we go, say, "This is The Takeaway, Bob." Bob.
This is The Takeaway.
Bob Jump, voiceover artist and the voice of Republican campaign commercials. Thanks so much.
Bravo, bravo.
Thanks, guys. Have a great morning. Thank you so much for having me on.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
I'm Adora Udoji, and you're listening to The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and Martti Ahtisaari, the former president of Finland, received the Nobel Peace Prize today for his efforts to build a lasting peace from Africa and Asia to Europe and the Middle East, particularly for his work to forge a compromise settlement on Kosovo. The Norwegian Nobel Committee said it honored Ahtisaari for important efforts over more than three decades to resolve international conflicts. And joining us now is Ira Vahaskari, who is the English language anchor for the Finnish National News Service, YLE. Ira, this is a moment of pride for the people of Finland.
No, absolutely. It's the first time that a Finn has won the Peace Prize. And to be fair, it's something that had been expected in previous times. He's been sort of rumored to be shortlisted at least twice before. And so now it came.
And, you know, I'm surprised to hear that because Helsinki and Finland is so associated with the sort of world government, world peace movement in some sense. And, the Helsinki Accords, all of that. It surprises me that someone from Finland hasn't won before.
Yeah. Well, I think that we'd be getting into a lot of sort of regional history here, but I think Finlandization under the shadow of the Soviet Union had a lot to do with it. In recent history, there's still been a very sort of careful, a desire to be seen, to be behind the scenes and off the radar, doing behind-the-scenes negotiations, and it's been other kind of high-profile people that have, if you think about the three people who won the Peace Prize for the Middle East Peace Conference, Yasser Arafat among them. So that was a very high-profile thing, and the Finns tend to be very low-key about what they're doing.
Well, that's very interesting. So President Ahtisaari is really someone who steps out of the traditional role of being behind the scenes and takes on a profile that could conceivably be controversial to some Finns.
Well, I don't really think he has stepped out. He's from behind the scenes. His whole personality and the way he does negotiation has just become very popular with very contentious issues, because he's kind of a rock and he has unlimited perseverance, and he will sit at a negotiating table until something happens, and he doesn't have a temper, he doesn't get excited about anything, and he will just sit there and wear them down until they agree to something.
Wow. What was his role in the Dayton Peace Accords?
I'm sorry?
What was his role in the Dayton Peace Accords, which brought peace to the Balkans and particularly the Kosovo situation?
Well, he had a lot of sort of unofficial roles. He was U.S. Special Envoy at one point, and he was also chairman of the Negotiating Peace Committee for Bosnia-Herzegovina at one point. And he also... You know, he led talks on Kosovo independence, and after talking to Serbia and Kosovo and trying to reach some kind of deal that would make both happy, he did come out with a very controversial recommendation and took to the UN to say, you know, we need to support Kosovo independence now. And, of course, that failed in the Security Council.
Well, you make a really interesting point that around the world, because of the style of Finnish diplomacy, people are going, who is this again? But people in Finland, of course, are going, it's about time. That's an interesting contrast. Ira Vahaskari is the anchor for the Finnish National News Service. Thank you so much for joining us.
Welcome.
On a moment of pride for all Finns, Martti Ahtisaari has received the Nobel Peace Prize today for his efforts to build a lasting peace from Africa and Asia to Europe and the Middle East.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 10th, and happy birthday, Mom. And now to Femi Oke, who's got the latest headlines at this hour. Femi.
And good morning, Mum, as well. How are you doing? 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Have a cup of tea and some toast later on. Thanks, Adora.
Very professional.
General Motors was hit especially hard in the massive sell-off yesterday. Their shares lost nearly a third of their value. Financial institutions and big oil companies also suffered big losses. Asian markets reacted tumultuously. The Nikkei closed down almost 10%. Stocks in Europe are tumbling as well, with the FTSE down around about 8%. NATO is joining other international forces in the fight against Somali pirates. The organisation sent military ships to protect boats off the coast of the country. Pirates took a Ukrainian ship laden with 33 tanks captive there 2 weeks ago, and they are still holding it. Now, we've been talking about negative campaigning this morning, and on the trail yesterday, the candidates fitted right into that theme. Barack Obama stayed with his message that John McCain is all over the place when it comes to the financial meltdown.
This is the kind of erratic behavior we've been seeing out of Senator McCain. You remember the first day of this crisis, he came out and said the economy was fundamentally sound. Then 2 hours later, he said we were in a crisis.
And McCain continued to focus on Obama's association with Weather Underground member Bill Ayers.
The point is, Senator Obama said he was just a guy in the neighborhood. We know that's not true. We need to know the full extent of the relationship because of whether Senator Obama is telling the truth to the American people or not.
And Senator Obama continues to say that Ayers has never been a friend and is not one of his top advisors. Let's look at some of your main stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
And with all the economic headlines that we've been hearing from Femi and reading about, seeing on television and hearing on the radio, it's been easy to miss other things that are happening in this country, perhaps especially in Minnesota and Florida, where there are two huge stories involving massive accusations of fraud, embezzlement, and international political shenanigans. Well, we're going to get a little more on those stories. We welcome right now Nancy Barnes, the Senior Vice President and Editor of the Star Tribune in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and John Yearwood, World Editor at the Miami Herald. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Let's start with you, Nancy, there in Minneapolis, St. Paul. A federal judge has called this case possibly the greatest fraud scheme in American history, and that's some really strong language. Tell us about this case.
This is a really jaw-dropping story. A couple of weeks ago, about 80 federal agents, tax authorities, et cetera, raided the headquarters of Tom Petters, who's a big figure here in Minnesota, businessman, investor in Sun Country Airlines, Polaroid, et cetera. And over the course of the last couple of weeks, it has unfolded that he has allegedly been running what appears to be one of the largest Ponzi schemes in history, involving fleecing investors of up to $3 billion.
The numbers are stunning. We're talking about allegations of a scheme that went on for 13 years, and allegedly two of his accomplices have confessed?
Several people have confessed. One woman who worked for him for nearly a decade started this off apparently just a month ago, walked in and confessed to authorities and then was their informer on this.
Because, Nancy, that's really one of the twists here. It's not as if investigators stumbled upon this scheme. It was because somebody told them about it.
That's right.
Huh.
What's astonishing is how long this has gone on, 13 years, how many the people who have been hurt by this include anything from, you know, little grandmas in Texas to some of the biggest businessmen in Minnesota. And then there are a number of people who willingly went along with this for years and knew about it.
Oh, I'm sure this is ruffling a few feathers there in Minnesota. But let's go to John in Florida and Miami. Now, you're talking about international intrigue there. You got Venezuela, Bolivia, and Argentina, and allegations of a suitcase full of hundreds of thousands of dollars. What's happening?
Well, for years now, we've been getting information from our sources throughout Latin America that the colorful president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, has been very much engaged in using his petrodollars to influence elections around the region. Well, we started getting a sense of that about a year ago when in Argentina, a suitcase containing about $790,000 was discovered or seized at the airport coming in on a private plane carried by a guy called Alejandro Antonini. Antonini happens to live here in South Florida, and he was going into Argentina with a number of businessmen. Well, the story probably would have ended there and been localized to Argentina and Venezuela had he not fled Argentina shortly after he left the airport and returned home to South Florida. And then he did an unusual thing. He called the FBI because, as we're finding out in the court proceeding that's going on now, he was concerned, or actually more feared, that the Venezuelan government will send people over to influence him. And it seems to be, based on the testimony that's coming out, that may exactly be what they did. One of the guy who is on trial right now, his name is Franklin Duran, actually mm-hmm. the main guy on trial, apparently came over from Venezuela, and he has been, according to testimony, trying to influence Antonini. And in doing that, the FBI had been listening to the phone calls and other meetings between Alejandro Antonini and Duran. And during these phone calls, they've discovered a whole slew of engagements between whether it's the Venezuelan government and Argentina. And ultimately, what we're finding out is that the money was intended for Cristina Kirchner, who at the time was running for president of Argentina. Eventually, of course, Cristina won the election, but there's
right.
a lot of intrigue that's left, and it's really fascinating.
And certainly lots of dominoes, but really quickly, I want you to get to, that's not the only one story making big headlines for you there, but also the aftermath of hurricane season. What's happening on that?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, we've been running stories from both Cuba and Haiti. And in fact, we had a major story on the front page this morning from inside Cuba looking at the housing damage that these various storms did. It's far more extensive than people had thought. And it happened in a place where housing was already squeezed. And in Haiti, what we're seeing is that the devastation from four back-to-back storms have left hundreds dead, and a town called Gonaives essentially without functioning authority in Gonaives. So
two very big stories there. But Nancy, let me go back to you. It's interesting that Petter's case, I can imagine, is something that a lot of people have opinions about. How do you think that story is going to play into how in Minnesota, you're talking about a very tight presidential race, how is it going to play into the campaign season, you think?
You know, I don't know if it's going to, I have a hard time seeing it affecting the presidential race. However, where I think it plays in is it just continues to fuel people's anger.
Right.
What we're seeing here, and I'm sure in other states in the last couple of weeks, is just a lot of people just angry about what's happened with the economy, angry about, you know, the mess on Wall Street, mad about, you know, businessmen, particularly CEOs, and their pay levels and walking away with money while everybody else is suffering. And here's an example again of, you know, if he's guilty of everything that he's accused of, somebody who's taking money from everybody else in order to fuel his own rich lifestyle. And I think that just contributes to the anger people feel, to how that plays out and how they vote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't tell you.
Oh, no, it's certainly been an unusual year. Very quickly, John, you get the last word here. Lots of anger there, too, that you're seeing?
Oh, absolutely. On the part of a number of people, and on a number of levels.
Mm-hmm.
Not only on some of the stories that we've been reporting on. And by the way, we've also I'd be remiss if I said we have been covering the economic meltdown.
Oh, of course, yes.
In a huge way, because as you know, here in South Florida, ground zero of the real estate collapse.
Yeah, the housing collapse. So you are very busy down there in Miami. John Yearwood,
absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us. John Yearwood, the world editor at the Miami Herald, and Nancy Barnes, thank you very much also.
My pleasure.
Nancy Barnes, editor and senior vice president at the Star Tribune.
Headlines you might have missed, but they all lead back to the financial crisis we've been covering. The political conversation continues on our election website, vote2008.thetakeaway.org. If you missed any of our Wall Street rescue coverage, catch up with us on iTunes.
And we've been asking you about words to describe the economic crisis.
Why don't we call what's happening global market warming, cashocalypse, the plague?
I think that the term would be the great deflation.
And I think the one lady was right on the money, you know?
Economics.
They call it economics.
Yes, economics.
Oh, that's your takeaway. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org with your meltdown replacement word. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.